Der ZZF-Podcast. Aus dem Leibniz-Zentrum für zeithistorische Forschung in Potsdam.
Welcome to our third episode of the English language edition of the ZZF podcast at the Leibniz Center for Contemporary Historical Research in Potsdam, Germany. I'm your host, Lee Holt, and today I'm speaking with Mario Bianchini. Mario is a research associate at the Leibniz Center for Contemporary Historical Research, a lecturer of history at the Barenboim Said Academy in Berlin, Germany, and the principal researcher on the German Democratic Republic for the Economic Collectivism, Old and New, Lessons from the Communist and Post-Communist Experience Project at the University of Vienna. Previously, he was a postdoctoral fellow at the Berlin Program for Advanced German and European Studies, based at the Freie Universität. His work has appeared in the Journal of Energy History, German Studies Review, Science, Technology, and Human Values, Das Jahrbuch für historische Kommunismusforschung, and Technologies Stories. Mario has also been the recipient of a Fulbright Research Grant, two DAAD, or German Academic Exchange Service grants, a DFD, German Research Foundation grant, and a Linda Hall Library Dissertation Research Grant. Welcome, Mario. So I wanted to start off by asking, how did you become interested in contemporary history? Was there a moment in your life that inspired you to study history? How did you come to this?
Of course, there's no linear trajectory for a lot of things, but if I have to sort of like affix this starting point, I think the time where I really became interested in history is probably like in high school when, you know, we were going through American history and these sort of like grand phases of what occurred. And I think once we started to approach what is essentially the Cold War, that I started to think like, well, how can all of this be? And especially when we were taught about Russia, which, you know, of course, we would fix the term Russia rather than Soviet Union. And, the, you know, the grand Eastern Bloc was just referred to as Russia. And what I was taught was basically that nothing happened there. And yet it was horrible, but also nothing happened. And so I started to get interested in, well, how can that be? What actually did occur in these places, especially when the Cold War was taught as this dialectic opposition between socialism and capitalism. And to me, I was interested in hearing what the other side was and why it was so important for us to fight this Cold War.
And so that led you into studying contemporary history, kind of get behind the curtain, so to speak, and see what's going on behind these narratives.
Right. Yeah. And I think also, I mean, this is now a much maligned book with historians of technology, but I think what also got me interested in history of technology is, in high school, we read a book, or I guess history of science too. We read a book called Longitude by Dava Sobel, and it was sort of about the invention of longitude. And I know that, you know, again, the overarching scholarly opinion of it is that it's an oversimplified book. She gets some things wrong, etc. But for me at the time in high school, I remember thinking, like, how could you take a subject that is at face value so boring and make it so exciting and actually, like, you know, teach you that these things that we don't think that much about are actually incredibly important and really shape our understanding of the world, etc. And that's really when I started to get interested in history of science and technology as well.
So your most recent book project that you're working on right now, I'm finishing up, is Real Existing Utopia, Technology, National Identity, and Work in the GDR. And what you just said about how you came to history speaks about discourse and ideas and imagination and how these things interact between the world of fact and the world of the imagined. How would you describe a utopia in East Germany?
Right. I mean, I don't think we have time to get into all the ins and outs of what a utopia is, but I think to sort of narrow it down to what I'm talking about in East Germany is in that book project, I'm arguing that there was a sort of idea that was circulated through either textbooks or newspaper articles or TV programs or radio programs in the GDR that pitched a future technological utopia. And in that, I mean, there would be a time where essentially infinite nuclear power could be used to power automated factories that would then eliminate the need for what they called Gutenarbeit, or drudgery. So that the end goal of the GDR would be this actual transference from socialism to communism by way of technological advancement. That once you could create a system that could essentially take over the means of production entirely through machinery, there would be no reason to work anymore. And that would free humans to write poetry or to play sports or, you know, anything that your mind could desire. But what ends up happening in a lot of ways is this becomes a sort of way of managing the present by way of the future. That, you know, of course, in order for that future to come about, you need to build it. You need to build the technologies to do that. And so this becomes a sort of justification for continuing to work in factories in the meantime, that you have to work in these factories because eventually you're going to build the systems to free yourselves. And that, of course, never comes to pass, but it acts as a way of legitimating the system in the meantime, that, you know, these problems are always already on their way to being solved. And so these goalposts keep moving all the time. And the utopian technologies that will be the thing that frees us changes, because as these things come about and they don't activate utopia, you need to reframe what will be the thing. So, for example, you know, early on, nuclear power was the thing that would free everyone. But this, you know, comes about and it doesn't actually, you know, it's not as limitless as people thought it would be. And then things move to space travel, but space travel doesn't actually end up ending the Cold War or freeing everyone from, you know, animosity between humans. Then there's a move towards cybernetics, but cybernetics is sort of undefined and amorphous. And then finally, the idea moves towards the computer. But because the GDR is so blockaded from the rest of computer technology, they don't really have the manpower to create their own computer infrastructure that could actually run automated factories, etc. And then this ends up culminating in the collapse of the GDR. And some part of that is probably related to a collapse of hope in these technologies, because each time you promise one of these things will free you and it does not, you lose some amount of hope.
So what I hear is there's on one side the promises of technological liberation, that if we build these technologies, then we'll create a world free of drudgery. At the same time, though, wasn't there an emphasis on the ennoblement of work in the GDR of the worker? And was there friction between these utopian leanings toward technological liberation and the ennobled worker?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think that the, you know, the ennoblement of work went away. It just changed, right? You can look at some paintings of Josip Renau, who painted like a famous painting called The Future Worker. And rather than, you know, the ideas that we associate maybe with Soviet worker art or Eastern Bloc worker art, whether it's into strong men with hammers or people working in factories, that this painting involves a lab-coated man looking over essentially like the universe and atoms and so forth, holding a protractor in his hand and sort of like having this distance between what's being worked on and himself, and sort of like everything having now completely turned to mental labor. And so, again, the future of work for humanity would be that of engineers, that people wouldn't have to do the drudgery of actual physical labor anymore. That would be entirely the providence of machines. But rather, whatever work humans did do would be that a mental category, and they would become machine minders or machine designers, or again, work in the creative field or some combination of both.
And how did disintegration of hope in these technologies proceed? Were there milestones along the way in the 60s, 70s, or 80s when people said, oh, these technologies aren't bringing us the liberation we wanted, or they're not even coalescing in the way they've been promised?
I think something like that is hard to define necessarily, because that would require, you know, interviews of people in the moment, because any interview you do at this point, you know, has the distance of the collapse of the GDR. So it's kind of a difficult thing to actually measure, but there are some ways I think you can get at that. And I think one of the most interesting things that I found was the Jugendweihe textbooks. And if you aren't familiar with what that is, it's essentially a youth's coming of age ceremony that is secular and kind of stands in for Christian confirmation. But like, rather than affirm a belief in God, you sort of pledge your allegiance to science and so forth. And you're at the end, you're not only addressed with Z rather than do, so you're an adult now. You're also given a textbook that's supposed to guide you in your life as an adult. And those textbooks change over time. There's Weltall Erde Mensch, there's Der Sozialismus deiner Welt, et cetera, et cetera. And the earlier versions of these textbooks are extremely clear on what the future would look like. In the earliest textbooks, you see drawings of automated factors. You see exactly how, or diagrams of how exactly energy inputs would go, how all trains would be moved underground to you know, save on noise, how the future of your homes would look, etc. But by the late 80s or the early 80s even, the textbooks have changed to become really thin. There's very few mentions of what the future will look like. There's very few specific technologies mentioned. They still have the same rhetoric of, you know, being on the verge of activating something great, but it becomes much more amorphous and less defined. And that change over time is sort of alluding to the fact that, okay, maybe if we do name something and then it doesn't happen, that's a problem for us. And I think in that way, you can see this degeneration of wanting to name a specific thing that will be the thing that activates what they call the scientific technological revolution.
So, when you're looking at these books, these Jugendweihe books, it makes me wonder if are there other texts and other genres, perhaps, that help populate this utopian imaginary of the technology?
Yeah, of course. There's science fiction, which I think is a, you know, general venue for utopian thinking. But, you know, GDR science fiction and, of, like, by extension, some Soviet science fiction or Polish science fiction was the sort of space to think through thought experiments of how the future would look. There's also the children's show Unser Sonnenschein, which, you know, has him traveling in spacecraft during the time when space travel was like the main utopian venue, and in showing children that not only is this possible, but it's something we're doing now. And like, the idea that, well, one could have this infinite energy to power these crafts, et cetera. So there are definitely other ways of seeing how the future is depicted.
Were there also puzzles, board games, toys? It's like a physical culture for, let's say, bringing this enthusiasm for technology to younger generations?
Absolutely. And that's one of the chapters of the book as well, is about hobbies and toys, etc. There are a few examples, but I'll just stick to one. I think that one of the most interesting was these computer toys that were produced by Pico, which was the main model train company for the GDR. There's the Pico Tron and the Pico Dot, which were meant to teach essentially Boolean logic for early coding, where you'd get a box with a bunch of wires and you connect them that would act as either zeros or ones, and you can set up logic gates, etc. And for the Pico Dot, this could then be used to program your model trains. You can say, okay, go to this station, okay, stop when this occurs, etc. Whereas with the Pico Tron, you could build your own radio, or you could build your own quiz machine, etc. Where the point was more experimentation and sort of learning how one could actually program a computer. And in the instruction booklets, the rhetoric was very clear that this is going to be the thing that helps you activate the scientific technological revolution, which is their essentially term for the turning point towards this technological utopia. They are careful not to use the term utopia because of its complicated notion of being a non-place, etc. But the notions of a perfect society are all hidden behind them. And its sort of point of activation is called the scientific technological revolution.
So when we're thinking about East Germany and how they're envisioning the scientific technological revolution, were there similar constructs in West Germany at the same time?
I think that one of the main differentiations with the West on a grander scale, not just in West Germany, but, you know, the United States, et cetera, is that I was always hard pressed to find a really specifying, you know, what some scholars have called a socio-technological imaginary, this idea in which a society in and of itself believes in an articulated version of the future, and that the society itself tries to move towards that. And in the U.S., for example, what would that be? I mean, I think that they specified utopia for the entire United States. I would be hard-pressed to find that. So I think that, you know, the goals of technological advancement, especially during the Cold War in the West, are a lot more ambiguous. That, you know, sometimes it's articulated is that your work will get easier or work hours will be reduced. But because, you know, capitalism is built on the concept of work, that like workers need to go to work in order to get money, and then that money needs to be returned into the system in order for the system to continue. The elimination of work is an elimination of the system itself on some level. So you can't ever fully articulate that. So you're left with this bizarre logical space where you're not really sure how to articulate that future. And you're not really sure what to do with the abolition of work. Whereas with the GBR, that was always the express goal, right? That's the point of communism. Whether or not the state actually ever wanted to move towards that. And because if the GDR does move to full communism and eliminates the state itself, well, then state power holders lose their power. So they also have a vested interest of working against their own future.
So let's turn briefly from the human world toward the natural world. You mentioned earlier that part of the visions of the future in the GDR included underground trains, or that there was a notion that technology could liberate human beings and perhaps also enable them to spend more time in the great outdoors. But what effects did this scientific technological revolution idea have on the environment in the GDR?
Right. Well, I mean, this is also something that really moves me into my next project of energy, where, you know, any energy production is going to have significant environmental impacts. But before really talking about energy, I think in these imaginaries that there was this idea that you could actually like merge nature and technology. There was these ideas of what were called the Großhügelhäuser that were never actually built, the giant hill houses. They essentially looked like, you know, ziggurats, where they would alternate their space that they would take up, so then neither, like, they wouldn't block each other's sun, and they were sort of built in a triangular pattern that would then have as many gardens as possible on the outside, so that they could, you know, meld housing and green space, because this was considered something that was important for humans, to have as much green space as possible. Again, moving the trains underground would help reduce noise. You could actually feel like you're more in nature, but also to, you know, not disturb plant life and animal life, etc. And East Germany was one of the first states on the planet to actually have an environmental protection law. So, like, a lot of these things were things that the Easterners did think about. But, you know, because of industrial production, because of energy production, environmental damage was something that occurred despite all of these considerations of nature and the environment.
And this leads me to ask, if nature was being damaged and the environment was being destroyed by technological progress, were there technological dystopias in East Germany?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's harder to sort of articulate the anti of something, right? But there's, you know, some of these dissident eco-Marxists. There's a book by someone named Amberger that really gets into a lot of these people, where they, you know, some of these dissident thinkers are some of the first degrowth theorists, like saying, okay, maybe actually we don't need to constantly grow industrial production. Maybe we can be happy with what we have. We don't actually need to live in essentially a consumerist society if we're going to say that we're socialists. So there is more of this move towards technology doesn't need to always go towards production, right? Rather than, you know, keeping with nature or trying to preserve things as much as possible. And, like, you know, medicine can still advance, et cetera, but maybe we don't need, you know, to constantly produce more toasters or something like that. And so in that way, they're articulating industrialization and consumerism as technological dystopias. And the GDR is actually copying the West in that way in producing a dystopia.
So part of producing this dystopia is caused by advances in energy and the harvesting and processing of coal and of the construction of nuclear power plants, et cetera, across Germany. I wanted to ask you about your work on energy and how you transition from technology and utopia into this new project that does with energy.
Yeah. So I think one of the things that I learned from the Eastern project was that, you know, one of the main promises, again, was this move towards automated factories that could infinitely produce for, you know, whatever needs the future East German would have. But if any production is infinite, that assumes an infinite input of energy. And that's impossible, right? I mean, you can't infinitely produce energy. So there's a fundamental illogic holding all of this together. And this is, you know, the new project is considering East and West Germany, but I'm arguing that they both are undergirded by a fundamental illogic that, you know, you can infinitely grow and also infinitely have energy. And so for the East Germans, this illogic was basically to be solved by nuclear energy, that because, you know, eventually someone will figure out a technology that can reuse waste, or eventually we'll figure out how to do nuclear fusion rather than nuclear fission, et cetera, that we hold the power to create infinite energy. But that's never happened, and it may not ever be possible. So to make a promise based on a possibility, this sort of technological fix in the future, really, again, allows one to continue the status quo unquestioned for as long as possible, right? That if anyone is going to say, hey, wait, why are we doing this? This doesn't make a lot of sense. The answer can always be, well, it will in the future. We'll figure it out in the future. It's a deferment of one of these problems. And this is, you know, the same logic of climate change, right? That we actually don't need to worry so much about burning fossil fuels, et cetera, because someday we'll build some sort of technology, be it carbon capture, be it, you know, again, nuclear fusion, et cetera, that will absolve us of the things we're doing now. And, you know, progress must go on. So who are we to stop what we're doing now? Because it will be figured out in the future. But again, I think the GDR is a great example of the danger of that logic, that the GDR collapsed and destroyed its environment in the process, all on the back of this promise that someday some technology would fix this. And that didn't occur. And now we're doing the same thing on a global scale. So I think it's much more pressing to think through these things.
When you say we're doing this at the global scale now, are you referring to the building of data centers to AI?
That's one thing for sure. I mean, the usage of energy by data centers is just astronomical. I mean, the one that was proposed in Utah would double the state's energy usage. Just the data center alone would use as much energy as the state itself already uses. And I mean, not only does that need energy inputs, it needs water inputs too. So you have, you know, this double environmental degradation, not only of burning fossil fuels to power these things, but also using, you know, potable water to then cool all of these systems. So yeah, I mean, it's not just data centers, but that's another example. I mean, like cars and anything, what have you, that, you know, industrial production of any kind, you know, is all still chasing, you know, GDP growth through increased production, etc. This logic of ever growing your business or what have you is fundamental to capitalism. All of these logics of growth mean growth in energy usage as well.
Where does the energy project stand right now?
Say, I would estimate I'm about halfway through the new book. You know, there's still more archival research to be done, especially on West Germany, about like how energy knowledge was articulated and especially presented to publics, right? Because this is the sort of fundamental question of the book is, what is public energy knowledge? If you want to plan for energy usage, and, you know, after the oil crises in the 1970s, it became increasingly important for governments to think, okay, well, if an energy input is suddenly interrupted, then what do we do? If everything in modern life requires energy, how do we plan for disturbances in that energy? How do we plan for regularities in energy? And one of the main question marks for energy planning is people. I mean, when you go home, you know, you are essentially free reign to use as much energy as you want. You could plug everything in your house in, but then, you know, how would an energy company plan for people to do that? What if people don't do that? You know, people are hard to sort of account for. So in order to try to make something so unplannable planable, there's an attempt to create a public energy knowledge, a way of knowing about energy that is a sort of hegemonic way, so that hopefully people will act in a predictable way so that you can plan for their energy usage. And I think that what's interesting is that what public energy knowledge ends up being is a sort of like question of conservation versus use. Sometimes, let's say, if you're an energy company who makes their money through selling energy, you want people to use as much energy as possible. If, for example, you are a nuclear power plant and you have to offload a certain amount of energy so that the plant itself doesn't explode because it can't offload its energy production, you want people to use more energy. But there are moments also, like the aforementioned oil crisis, where you want people to use less energy, where energy is suddenly a very precious thing. And so the way that energy is predicted in media and in news and in politics changes based on these grander world relationships with energy. So, you know, during times of more energy usage, oftentimes you'll see imageries of oil production or gas, et cetera, that is depicted as something that's important for your life as a modern citizen, that these are not oil companies necessarily, they're energy companies. They are producers of modernity, that you are living a modern life because of this. But then during a time of scarcity, a lot of these infrastructures are made invisible, and that energy is suddenly very precious, that it is not infinite, that it is a material good, that we need to take this out of the earth. And it would be wasteful of us to ever think otherwise. But these are fundamentally, you know, conflicting ideas of thinking about energy. Sometimes it's infinite, sometimes it's extremely material, sometimes it's abstracted. So the public energy knowledge acts as a sort of paradox in a lot of ways. It is both material and immaterial, infinite and precious. So I think it's really interesting to see how that changes over time and how politics really plays into the depiction of energy and the understanding of energy.
Thank you, Mario, for joining us today. And thank you for this very interesting discussion about not only utopia, technology, national identity work, but also the way that energy is discussed in these hegemonic narratives that create a paradox between scarcity and supply. Thank you.
Thanks, Lee.
Der ZZF-Podcast aus dem Leibniz-Zentrum für zeithistorische Forschung in Potsdam.